Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Matt Jensen number 3, Purgatory. Narrated by Dylan Lynch. With performances by Tony Penny, David Coyne, Joe Brack, Tim Carlin, Michael Glenn, Michael John Casey, Christopher Graybill, Andy Clements, Dylan Lynch, James Konacek, Ren Casey, Karen Novak, Kimberly Gilbert, Yasmin Twazon, Drew Copus, Scott McCormick, Christopher Sheeran, Eric Messner, Johan Detweiler, and Ken Jackson.
The rain that had been threatening for the day started shortly after nightfall. In the distance, lightning flashed and thunder roared, and the rain beat down heavily upon the small Arizona town, cascading off the eaves before drumming onto the roof of the porch just below the second-story window of the Morning Star Hotel. Matt Jensen was standing at the window of his hotel room, looking down on the street of the town. There were few people outside, and when someone did go outside, they would dart quickly through the rain until they found a welcome door to slip through. The town was dark, the rain having extinguished all outside lamps, and the lanterns that were inside provided only the dullest gleam through rain-shrouded windows. The meager illumination did little or nothing to push away the gloom of the night. The room behind Matt glowed with a soft golden light, for he had lit the lantern and it was burning very low. Though Matt was used to the outdoors and had spent many a night sleeping on the prairie in just such conditions, this was one of those nights where he appreciated being under a roof. Matt Jensen was just a bit over 6 feet tall, with broad shoulders and a narrow waist. He was a young man in years, but his pale blue eyes bespoke of experience that most would not see in 3 lifetimes. He was a lone wolf, who had worn a deputy's badge in Abilene, ridden shotgun for a stagecoach out of Lordsburg, scouted for the Army in the McDowell Mountains of Arizona, and panned for gold in Idaho. A banker's daughter in Cheyenne once thought she could make him settle down. A soiled dove in the territories knew that she couldn't, but took what he offered. Matt was a wanderer, always wondering what was beyond the next line of hills just over the horizon. He traveled light with a Bowie knife, a .44 double-action Colt, a Winchester .44-40 rifle, a rain slicker, an overcoat, 2 blankets, and a spare shirt and spare socks, trousers, and underwear. He called Colorado his home, though he had actually started life in Kansas. Colorado was home only because it was where he had reached his maturity, and Smoke Jensen, the closest thing Matt had to a family, lived there. In truth, though, he spent no more time in Colorado than he did in Wyoming, Utah, New Mexico, or Arizona. He was in Wickenburg, Arizona now, having arrived just ahead of the train and just before dark. He had no reason to be in Wickenburg. He had arrived here in a restless drift that neither proposed a particular destination nor had a sense of purpose. He was about to turn away from the window when he saw 2 men holding 1 man while a 3rd was hitting him. When the lightning went away, he could see nothing except the darkness of the alley, and for a moment, Matt wasn't sure that he had seen anything. It might have been a trick of shadows and light. Lifting the window, he crawled out onto the edge of the hotel's porch roof, moved through the rain to the edge, then dropped down to the ground. Matt moved quickly through the rain, unseen and unheard by either the assailants or the hapless man being beaten. Reaching out, he grabbed the shoulder of the man doing the actual beating, spun him around, then knocked him down with a hard blow to the man's chin.
What the hell?
Matt started toward him, but he and his partner released the beating victim and ran quickly up the alley. The beating victim collapsed, and Matt decided that attention to his condition was more important than chasing down the two villains.
Look out!
Matt saw the man he had knocked down reaching for his gun. Because he was still lying on the ground, it was an awkward draw, which gave Matt time to step through the mud and kick the pistol out of the man's hand. Unarmed now, the man turned over onto his hands and knees and crawled far enough away to regain his feet. Then he, like the other two men, ran away.
You hurt?
A few bruises and cuts. No broken bones, thanks to you.
Come on. Let's get in out of the rain.
That's a good idea. Oh, have you had your supper yet? If not, I'd like to treat you. I owe you.
You don't owe me anything. I think anyone would have come to your aid if they had seen what was going on.
I'm not sure of that, but I'd like to buy you dinner anyway. The name's Garvey. Stan Garvey.
Matt Jensen.
I'm glad to meet you, Mr. Jensen. Whew, that's an understatement. I'm damn glad to meet you. Little Man's Cafe is just down the street here. Little man makes a damn good pot roast.
Matt followed Garvey into the restaurant, and the two men stood just inside the door for a moment, dripping water. Because it was quite late for dinner, the restaurant was nearly empty.
Hello, Stan. Wet enough for you?
The man who greeted them was wearing the white apron and cap of a cook. He was very short, standing just over 5 feet tall.
Hello, little man. Two pot roast dinners.
Two pot roast dinners coming right... Oh, damn, Stan, what the hell happened to you?
I fell down.
You fell down?
Yes.
Well, all I can say is it must have been one hell of a fall.
You have any apple pie left?
Yes. Yeah, you want it now?
No, for dessert.
Leading Matt to a quiet corner of the dining room, Garvey took out a handkerchief to dab at his bloody lip. The handkerchief was as wet as his clothes.
Who were those men?
I don't know the two who are holding me. But the one doing the hitting was a man named Odom. Cletus Odom.
What'd you do to make Odom so angry?
Garvey held up his finger as if suggesting that Matt wait for a moment. Then he got up from the table and walked over to the counter. Picking up a newspaper, he returned to the table and handed the paper to Matt.
Well, this might have done it.
Garvey pointed to a story on the front page.
A Villain Walks Among Us. Story by Stan Garvey. If there were no other reasons why Arizona should strive for early statehood, then the lack of any sense of justice would be reason enough. On the 5th, three men entered the Bank of Wickenburg with the express purpose of robbing it. Their attempt was foiled by the fast and heroic action of Adam Thomas, who slammed the safe shut. When the leader of the robbers demanded that Thomas reopen the safe or forfeit his life, Thomas maintained his resolve. As a result, the leader of the robbers shot and killed this brave husband and father of two. There are credible eyewitnesses who say that, despite the fact that he was wearing a mask, they recognize Cletus Odom as the robber and murderer. They are not shy in making these claims, but thus far no arrests have been made. That means that Cletus Odom is free to roam about, unafraid of any possibility of apprehension. Perhaps if Arizona enjoyed statehood, its citizens would have sufficient voice in the state capital to force more effort into bringing the murderer Odom to justice. As editor of this newspaper, I will do all within my power to see to it that Odom is brought to justice. I call upon you, who are citizens of the territory of Arizona, as well as citizens of our fair city of Wickenburg, to write a letter to Governor Fremont demanding that justice be done, and that Cletus Odom pay the supreme penalty for his foul deed.
That's quite a story, Mr. Garvey.
Thanks.
But with Odom still free, do you not think it was a little risky to write such a story?
My good man, freedom of the press is one of our nation's most precious rights. I will not be intimidated by the mere threat of violence.
From my observation, Mr. Garvey, this wasn't a threat. This was an actuality.
At that moment, little man arrived carrying two plates.
Enjoy your dinner, gentlemen. And Stan, I'll put the two pieces of pie in the warming oven so they'll be nice and hot for you.
Thanks.
I have to say, after several days of eating on the trail, this is very good.
I thought you might like it. Are you new to Wickenburg, Mr. Jensen?
I'm just passing through.
Passing through, are you? Where are you going? Oh, it's rude of me to be so nosy, I know. I beg your forgiveness, but this unbridled curiosity is what made me become a journalist, I suppose.
That's all right. I don't mind answering, because to tell the truth, I'm not going anywhere in particular. I've just been wandering from place to place.
Like a tumbleweed.
You might say that. I have no family encumbrances, nobody to worry about. Don't worry about me. This is a big country, Mr. Garvin. I just thought I'd see as much of it as I can.
Well, I envy you that freedom, Mr. Jensen. I truly do. But from a personal point of view, I'm certainly glad you chose this night of all nights to be in Wickenburg. I'm not sure what condition I would be in now if you'd not come to my rescue. How long are you going to stay with us?
I'll be leaving at first light in the morning.
Ah, to continue your adventure.
You might say that.
Are you a writer, Mr. Jensen?
I'm not sure what you mean by that question. If you're asking if I can read and write, the answer's yes.
No, my question is more specific than that. I mean, do you keep a journal of sorts, an account of your wanderings and adventures?
No, I don't. Nor could I imagine anyone would ever want to read about me.
Oh, don't be so sure about that. You see, I have a very strong theory that the American West will be the source of lore and legend for many generations to come. And it's people like you, wanderers and heroes. Yes, heroes. Did you or did you not come to my assistance tonight? And might I add, at no small danger to yourself.
I saw that you were in trouble, and I did what anyone else would have done under the circumstances.
No, Mr. Jensen, don't be so self-deprecating. Very few would have done what you did tonight. That's why I believe that someday someone will write stories about you. If not about you personally, certainly about the kind of person you represent. And I don't just mean the penny dreadful.
I must say, that is an interesting observation, Mr. Garvey, but I would turn that around. If you want my opinion, if any of this West is to be preserved, it'll be because of men like you. Newspaper men who are not afraid to write the truth. You are the true heroes of the West.
A toast, Mr. Jensen. A toast between heroes.
Matt touched his own coffee cup to Garvey's.
A toast.
McKinley Peterson had named his saloon the Paradise because he thought the idea of paradise in a town called Purgatory made an interesting contrast. The saloon was a great success, but Peterson didn't live long enough to enjoy it. He was killed within 6 months of opening the saloon, and because he died intestate, the saloon was put up for sale at a city marshal's auction. Announcement of the auction appeared as a two-line entry in the Purgatory Purge, the town's only newspaper. Paradise Saloon, to be sold at city marshal's auction, 2 a.m. Saturday. Andrew Cummins was the city marshal of Purgatory. It was not by coincidence that Andrew Cummins was also the only one who showed up for the auction. And because the city marshal owned Paradise, the saloon soon became the de facto city marshal's office, as Cummins spent all his time there. Although there was a mayor and a city council, the real power in town belonged to Marshal Cummins. He backed up his power by having a personal cadre of 8 deputies, all chosen for their skill with a gun and their willingness to use physical force when necessary. In fact, they often used physical force when it wasn't necessary. But complaints to the city council fell upon deaf ears. One reason the city council was not responsive to citizens' complaints was because 4 of the 7 council members were Cummins' deputies. Marshal Cummins was able to maintain a large force of deputies because the town had imposed a draconian tax, which was extracted not only from every business, but from every household every week.
Hey!
Cummins was standing at the front of the saloon looking over the batwing doors out onto the street. The westbound train was sitting down at the depot waiting to continue its journey. Half a dozen passengers had detrained, and one, who had separated himself from the others, was standing in the street, looking around as if trying to get his bearings. From the way the man was dressed, it was obvious that he was from the East.
Hey, if you boys want to laugh, come over here and take a look at this.
Take a look at what?
Emil Jackson was one of Marshal Cummins' deputies.
Take a look at the hat on that little feller out there.
The object of Cummins' derision was a bowler hat with a small brim and a low, round crown.
What is that thing he's wearing on his head? Is that a piss pot?
Like Jackson, Mo Gillis was a deputy. Soon, all the other deputies were standing at the batwing doors, looking out into the street at the smallish man who was wearing not only a bowler hat, but a three-piece suit.
Hey, Marshal, I bet you can't shoot that hat off its head.
Well, sure I can.
A beer says you can't.
You mean you'll buy me a beer if I shoot the hat off his head?
Yep, but you buy me one if you miss.
All right. I guess it's about time I showed you boys why I'm the Marshal. And you all is the deputy.
Cummins drew his pistol and aimed, then lowered it.
What's wrong? Can't do it?
Stand here in front of me and let me use your shoulder as a brace.
Hell no, you have to do it yourself, or admit you can't do it.
You don't worry about me, I can do it.
Cummins aimed again, then leaned against the wall and braced the pistol against a door frame. The little man wearing a bowler hat fell back in the street. Several of the deputies ran out to him. There was a small, dark hole in the man's temple, and a trickle of blood ran down across his ear.
Son of a bitch, Marshal, you killed him.
Oh, shit. It was an accident. Y'all seen it. It was an accident. I didn't mean to shoot him.
An hour later, Marshal Cummins stepped into the undertaker's parlor. The man he shot was lying naked on a lead-covered slab. Beneath the slab was a bucket filled with blood. Hanging from a hook over the slab was a bottle of formaldehyde, and a little tube ran from the bottle through a needle in the arm and into the dead man's veins.
Hello, Prufrock. How you doing with him?
I'm about finished. Who's going to pay me for this? The town?
No, I'm the one who killed him. I'll pay the charges. I didn't mean to kill him, but I feel like I should pay the charges anyway. Have you found out who he is?
His name is Cornelius Jerome. He's from New York City.
Well, how do you know?
There's a letter in his pocket to Governor John C. Fremont.
He wrote a letter to the governor?
He didn't write it. His pa did. Turns out his pa is some bigwig back in New York. You want to read the letter?
Yeah.
It's over there on that table.
Walking over to the table, Cummins saw, in addition to the letter, the other personal effects belonging to the man. A pipe, then a pouch of tobacco, a pair of glasses, and a billfold. Looking in the billfold, Cummins saw over $300 in cash. He read the letter.
To the Honorable John C. Fremont, Governor of Arizona Territory. Governor, I am sure you remember me as one of your most active supporters in your run for presidency in 1856. I also served as your adjutant in St. Louis during the Civil War. Although our paths have not crossed since that time, I have followed your fortunes with great interest. By this letter, I want to introduce my son, Cornelius Jerome. Actually, this will not be the first time you have met him. For, indeed, you often held him on your lap during the exciting days of the election campaign. Oh, shit. It is my intention that my son make his fortune, if not in money, then by life experiences as he sojourns through our great American West. I call upon you as an old friend to make him welcome and to provide him with the advice you should deem necessary. Sincerely, your friend, Ronald J. Jerome, New York, New York. Oh, damn, he sounds rich, don't he?
I'd say so.
Well, who would have thought about this odd-looking little feller?
What do you want me to do with the body?
What the hell do you mean? You're doing it, aren't you?
I mean, after I'm finished here, what should I do next?
I bury him? I don't know.
Shouldn't we send him back home?
Well, how can we do that? We don't know where he came from.
Oh, sure we do. It's right there in the letter.
Pointedly, Cummins tore up the letter. Then he took the $300 from the Jerome's billfold and pressed it into Prufrock's hands.
What letter?
I don't know. I didn't see any letter.
By any definition of a term, Cletus Odom was an ugly man. A scar like a purple flash of lightning ran from his forehead, through his left eye, and down his cheek to hook in under his nose. As a result of the scar, the eyelid was now a discolored and misshapen puff of flesh. For a while, the eye had been black and swollen as a result of an encounter he'd had 3 weeks ago in an alley in Wickenburg. Angry over an article that had appeared in the Wickenburg newspaper, Odom had found a couple of men in the saloon there who, for the price of a drink, agreed to help him teach the newspaper editor a lesson. Odom had not expected anyone to come to Garvey's aid and was surprised when someone appeared out of nowhere to interrupt him. It was time to move on, and he had a plan in mind that would net him a lot of money. All he needed to implement the plan were a few men who would work with him, and he had already set about recruiting them. Odom had reached the tiny town of Quigatoa, Arizona, just after nightfall. Quigatoa was a scattering of fly-blown and crumbling adobe buildings that were laid out in no particular pattern around a dusty plaza. What made the town attractive to people like Odom was its reputation as a robber's roost or outlaw haven. The town had no constable or marshal, and visitations by law officers from elsewhere in the territory were strongly discouraged. There was a place in the town cemetery prominently marked as Lawman's Plot. Here, a deputy, an Arizona Ranger, and a deputy U.S. Marshal, all uninvited visitors to the town, lay buried. Odom had come to Quigatoa as a first step to set his plan into operation, and stepping into the Casa del Sol Cantina, he spotted someone sitting at a table in the back. He was a big man, with a broken nose that lay flat and misshapen on a round face.
Hello, Bates.
I thought you was gonna get here today.
It is today.
Yeah, I meant earlier.
Well, I'm here now. Did you get someone else?
Yeah, you wanna meet him?
Tomorrow. I had a long ride today.
All right.
Leaving Bates, Odom bought a bottle of tequila, then picked up a Mexican whore and went with her to her little crib out back, as much for her bed as for her services.
You think Rosita is pretty, senor?
Pretty? What the hell do I care whether you're pretty or not? You're a puta, a whore. All whores look just alike to me. All I want you to do is shut up, get naked, and get in bed. I'm not in the mood for any of your prattle.
Si, senor.
Mechanically, she took off her clothes and crawled in bed beside him. She turned off all feeling as he climbed on top of her. Even as Odom was settling down for the night in Quigatoa, Mad Jensen had just found a likely place to camp for the night. Dismounting, he took off the saddle and blanket. This was Matt's second horse to be named Spirit. The first was killed by an outlaw who was trying to kill Matt. Spirit One was a bay, given to Matt by Smoke Jensen, Matt's mentor and friend. Spirit Two was a sorrel. Matt had named him Spirit as well, in part honor to his first horse, but also because he considered Spirit Two to be worthy of the name. Matt spread the saddle blanket out on the ground to provide a base for his bedroll, then, using the saddle for a pillow, prepared to spend the night on the range. To the casual observer, the saddle, which was ordinary in every detail, was no different from any other saddle. There was, however, one very extraordinary thing about it. The saddle had a double bottom, which allowed him to secret away more than $1,000 in cash, which Matt used as his emergency reserve. Nobody who happened to see Matt would ever suspect that he was carrying so much money. In fact, Matt had a lot more money than that in a bank account back in Colorado. He had come by the money honestly as part of a gold panning operation he had entered into with Smoke Jensen back when he was but an 18-year-old boy. At dawn the next day, the notches of the eastern hills were touched with the dove gray of early morning. Shortly thereafter, a golden fire spread over the mountaintops, then filled the sky with light and color, waking all the creatures below. Matt rolled out of his blanket and started a fire, then began digging through his saddlebags for coffee and tobacco. He would have enjoyed a biscuit with his coffee, but he had no flour. He had no beans either, and was nearly out of salt. He did have a couple of pieces of bacon, and they now lay in his skillet alongside his coffee pot. After his breakfast, Matt sat down and contemplated his next move. It was clear that he was going to have to replenish his supplies.
Spirit, I think it's about time we went into town again.
Sometimes on the long, lonely trail, Matt felt the need to hear a human voice, even if it was his own. Talking to Spirit satisfied that need, and because he was talking to his horse, it didn't seem quite as ridiculous as talking to himself. In the Casa del Sol cantina the next morning, Odom rolled a tortilla in his fingers and, using it like a spoon, scooped up the last of his breakfast beans. He washed it down with a drink of coffee, then looked up as Emerson Bates came over to his table.
Here's the man I was telling you about.
Bates indicated the man who was with him.
His name is Paco Bustamante.
The man with Bates was short, but looked even shorter by comparison with Bates. He had obsidian eyes, a dark, brooding face, and a black mustache that curved down around either side of his mouth. He was wearing an oversized sombrero.
He's a Mex. I don't work with Mexicans.
Paco's a good man.
How do you know?
Me and him have done a couple jobs together. And besides, you slept with his sister last night.
Well, if you come along, Paco, you only get half a share.
Without a word, Paco turned and started to walk away.
Well, I reckon if you got that much gumption, you might do after all. What do you do for a full share?
Anything you say, senor.
Well, there might be some killing.
I do not want to be the one who is killed. But I do not mind if I'm the one doing the killing.
You're in.
If Odom had expected some expression of gratitude from Paco, he was disappointed. For neither by word nor gesture did he respond. Instead, he looked at Odom with his unblinking black eyes.
What about Schuler? You get him?
Odom? You sure you want Schuler?
Yeah, I'm sure.
He's a drunk.
I know he's a drunk. He's also a good powder man. Last job I pulled, the son of a bitch slammed the safe shut on me. I don't intend to let that happen again. If I have to, I'll blow the damn safe this time. But I want someone who can do it without killing us all. Now go get him.
I already got him. He's out front.
Yeah, bring him in.
Bates walked to the front door and pushed the beaded strings to one side.
Schuler, get in here.
The man who answered Bates' call was of medium height and very thin. His face was red, though whether from natural complexion or from skin long unwashed and subjected to alcohol, well, no one knew. His eyes were so pale a gray that, at first glance, they looked to be without color of any kind. He shuffled up to the table.
You know why I asked for you?
Well, you said you had a job for me.
Well, I might, if you can do it.
I can do it.
How do you know you can do it?
You have something you want blown.
What makes you think I want something blown?
I'm a drunk. You wouldn't want me for anything unless it was for something. I was the only one who could do it. I'm a powder man. That means you want something blown.
Yeah. Let me see your hands.
Why do you need to see my hands?
Hold them out there. Let me see them.
Schuler held his hands out for Odom's inspection. They were shaking badly.
Damn. Look at that. Hell, shaking like that, you couldn't even light the fuse, let alone plant a charge.
Give me a drink.
You've had too much to drink already.
Give me a drink.
Schuler tossed the drink down, then held his hands out again. They were steady as a rock.
I'll be damned. All right, you're in.
I'm in what?
Does it really matter as long as there's money in it?
How much money, senor?
A lot of money. If you was to take all the money the four of us have ever had in our whole lives and put it in one pile, it wouldn't make so much as one share of the money I'm talking about now. You boys interested?
Hell yes, I'm interested. I told you that from the beginning, you know that.
What about you, Paco?
Si, senor. I'm interested.
What do you want me to blow?
A safe.
Where's the safe?
In a train.
A train? Are you planning to hold up a train?
Yeah. You got a problem with that?
Oh, no, I don't have a problem with that.
When do we do it?
Couple more days. I'll let you know when it's time.
When Matt Jensen first encountered the town of Purgatory, Arizona, It rose from the prairie in front of him so indistinct in form and substance that it resembled nothing more than a rise of hillocks and rocks. But as he drew closer, the hillocks and rocks began to take on shape and character until it was obviously a town. It had been a long ride since the last waterhole, and Matt's canteen was down to less than a third full. But the sight of a town gave promise of more water, so he stopped and allowed himself a long drink.
I wish I had some for you, Spirit. There's water just ahead, and I promise you your fill, as well as a good rub down and a supper of oats.
Matt hooked the empty canteen onto his saddle, then slapped his legs against Spirit's side to urge him on down into the town. A rabbit jumped up alongside the road and ran in front of him for a little while before darting off to one side. A hand-painted sign greeted him at the edge of town.
Purgatory. Population 263. Obey our laws.
Just beyond the sign was a house, and in the yard of the house was a water pump. An old woman was pumping water into a bucket, though it was obvious that the pumping action was difficult for her. Smelling the water, Spirit tossed his head. Matt headed toward the pump.
Afternoon, ma'am. May I pump for you?
The woman, who could have been anywhere between 50 and 80, looked at him with eyes that were too tired to be frightened. Without saying a word, she relinquished the pump handle. Matt filled the bucket, then handed it to the woman.
Wonder if I might have a little of your water for my canteen and my horse.
You are welcome to the water.
Thank you.
Matt took his hat off, put it under the pump, and filled it with water. Holding the hat in front of his horse, he watched as the animal drank thirstily. It took three more hats to slake the horse's thirst. Not until then did Matt fill his own canteen.
You are a kind mind, sir, to see the thirst of your horse before yourself.
I've managed to drink a little from time to time. He hasn't. His thirst was much greater than mine.
Matt put the canteen back onto his saddle, then handed the woman $2. The woman took the money without comment. Never once, during Matt's entire time here, had the expression on her face changed. The old woman looked as if just staying alive had become a tiring effort. Matt rode on into town, looking it over as he entered. The town consisted of the usual stores and businesses, a general store, an apothecary, a leather goods store, a gun shop, a dress shop. All the buildings were of rip-sawed, sun-dried lumber, most with false fronts, thus aspiring to more substance than they actually possessed. Matt rode slowly on up the street. Except for him, the street was empty. Several of the townspeople inside the buildings heard the sound of a solitary rider, but few ventured to look outside and see who it might be. Matt stopped in front of the Paradise Saloon, the name illustrated by a pair of dice showing the number 7. Matt hung his wet hat on the saddle horn so that the sun would dry it. Just as he started toward the front porch and the promise of a late morning breakfast, a man stepped out of the saloon. He was a tall man, dressed in black. He had a star on his chest, and he wore his pistol hanging low to his right side.
That'll be $5.
I beg your pardon?
$5!
Well, I don't understand. $5 for what?
For a visitor's tax. We charge everyone who visits our town $5.
Oh, well, I can take care of that. I just won't visit your town.
You already have.
Mister, I just rode into town. I didn't know anything about your $5 tax.
You don't have $5? Maybe I should lock you up for vagrancy.
It's not the money, it's the principle of the thing. Whoever heard of a town charging $5 just to visit? Well, if you were going to do such a thing, the least you could do is post a sign just outside of town so people could be warned.
Tell that to city council, but first give me the $5.
I told you I'm not going to visit your town. I'll just ride on.
And I told you you've already visited the town. Now you'll either give me the $5 or I'll shoot you down in the street and take it off your dead body.
What?
You heard me.
Mister, you need to let this drop. I told you, I'm gonna just...
Suddenly, Matt saw the lawman's hand going for his pistol.
No!
That was fast, very fast. The bullet hit the lawman in the chest and, with a surprised expression on his face, the lawman dropped his gun, then slapped his hand over the wound. Ironically, when he dropped his gun, it slipped back into his holster. He turned around and walked back into the saloon through the back wing doors.
Well, what is it, Mo? What was that shot about?
Mo looked at Cummins with a peculiar expression on his face, then fell to the floor. At that moment, Matt stepped inside as well, still holding the smoking gun.
Mo! My God, he's dead!
Oh, you dropped that gun, mister!
Looking up, Matt saw a man wearing a star pointing a pistol at him. One man pointing a pistol might not have been so bad, but there were four other pistols being pointed toward him as well as a double-barrel shotgun, all being wielded by men who were wearing stars.
How many marshals does this town have?
I'm Marshal Cummins. These men and the man you just murdered are my deputies.
Well, I didn't murder him. He drew on me first.
Oh, he drew on you, huh? Mister, you're a liar, and a poor one at that. Moe's gun is still in this holster.
Yes, it fell back in the holster when I shot him.
Mister, I didn't fall off the turnip wagon yesterday. Now drop the damn gun.
Matt took in the situation around him, then, realizing that resistance would be futile, he dropped his gun and raised his hands.
Put some cuffs on him, Jackson.
Get a rope. Let's hang the son of a bitch now.
I got a new rope. I'll go get it.
No.
Come on, Marshal Cummins. You know damn well he's guilty. Hell, you got a whole saloon full of eyewitnesses.
Well, that's right, Hayes. We do. That's why we're going to do this all legal-like, see? We're going to try him now, find him guilty, then send him to Yuma and let them hang him.
When are we gonna try him? The circuit judge ain't due back for near about a month.
We don't need to wait for a circuit judge. Well, we'll try him right here, right now. Y'all forget, I'm an associate judge.
What about the jury?
Hell, there's at least 30 men in here. Bartender, why don't you pick out 12 of them? And to make it legal, don't pick none of my deputies.
All right, I'll be one of the jurors. You, and you.
The bartender pointed to the others in the saloon until he had assembled a jury of 12 men.
Now, you put the jury here.
Cummins pointed to an area of the saloon that was near the cold iron stove.
Set up 12 chairs. Deputy Pike, you'll be the bailiff. Morgan, you and Gates, move a table over there to give me a place to sit. And set a table for the defense and there for the prosecution.
There was a scurry of activity as the saloon was turned into a courtroom.
As of now, the bar is closed.
Come on, Marshal, what's the harm of a drink if all we're gonna do is watch? You done said there can't none of us deputies be on a jury.
Now, I intend this to be a proper court. The bar is closed. Hayes, you're going to be the prosecutor.
I ain't no lawyer, Marshal.
I know you're not no damn lawyer, but we only got us one real lawyer in town, and that's Bob Dempster. I only think it's fair that the defendant get the real lawyer.
Dempster? Yeah, all right, I don't mind going up against Dempster.
Oh, he's back there in the corner. Deputy Posey, go get him.
When Matt looked back into the corner Cummins had indicated, he saw a man sitting at a table. A whiskey bottle was on the table beside him, and his head was down on the table. He was either asleep or passed out.
Hey, Dempster!
Dempster made no response.
Dempster! Are you dead? Or are you just drunk?
Oh, somebody get a pitcher of water.
A moment later, someone showed up with it, handing it to Posey.
Dempster! Wake up!
What is happening? Whiskey?
No whiskey, Dempster. The bar is closed.
Closed? What do you mean closed? It's still light. Oh, is it Sunday?
It's closed because the saloon has been turned into a courtroom. Say, we're about to have us here a trial, and I've appointed you to defend the bastard who murdered Mo Gillis.
You have appointed me?
Yeah.
Marshal Cummins.
Well, for the purposes of this trial, I am acting not as marshal, but as an associate judge, and you will refer to me as such.
Your Honor, I can't act as an attorney. I'm in no condition to act as an attorney.
Oh, yeah? Well, you don't have any damn choice. I appointed you, and you will defend this man, or I will throw you in jail for contempt of court. And I don't have to remind you, do I, Counselor? You won't be getting anything to drink while you're in jail.
Dempster sat at the table for a long moment, looking around at everyone who was staring at him. It was obvious that he was very uncomfortable with the scrutiny of all the patrons. He ran his hand across his wet face one more time.
Where's the defendant?
Right there.
Cummins pointed toward Matt. Matt was still standing with his hands cuffed behind his back.
Take his cuffs off.
He's my prisoner.
Right now, he's a defendant in a court trial, and he's innocent until proven guilty. As the court-appointed attorney for the defense, I am ordering you to take off his cuffs.
Jackson made no move to comply.
Your Honor.
Cummins looked over toward Jackson and nodded.
I'll take them off.
Jackson complied with the order, and Matt brought his hands back around front and rubbed the wrists.
Your Honor, I'll need a few minutes to consult with my client.
I'll give you 15 minutes.
And some coffee. Strong and black.
Polly, get the counselor some coffee.
Back here, please.
Matt walked back into the corner of the saloon, then sat at the table with Dempster. Dempster's silver hair was unkempt, and though he didn't have a beard as such, he was badly in need of a shave. He was wearing a jacket and white shirt, but both were badly worn and, from the smell, had not seen a cleaning in some time.
Hey, Marshal! While we're waiting, could we have another drink?
Yeah! After all, it's your saloon! If you keep us from buying drinks, you're just cutting off your own nose to spite your face.
All right, Polly. Go ahead and open the bar. You can keep it open for 15 minutes, but then the trial starts and you got to close it.
Right.
The fact that the opening was temporary was very good for business, because nearly everyone in the saloon, including all the jurors, rushed to the bar to get drinks before time ran out. One of the deputies brought a pot of coffee and a single cup to Dempster's table.
Bring a cup for the defendant.
We ain't here to enjoy no coffee.
I'll give him a cup, Foster.
Begrudgingly, Deputy Foster went into the kitchen, then returned with another coffee cup. By the time he returned, Dempster was already on his second cup of coffee.
What's your name?
Jensen. Matt Jensen.
Did you kill, who is it you killed?
I believe they said his name was Gillis, Mo Gillis.
Gillis. Well, if you were going to kill someone, that son of a bitch needed it more than just about anyone else I can think of. Let me ask you this. Did you kill him in cold blood?
No, I...
That's enough. I'd rather hear you tell your side during the trial. It'll give it more spontaneity.
All right.
Dempster, your 15 minutes are up.
Your Honor, can I request a 24-hour delay so that I can, so that I could be in better condition to present my case to the court?
Dempster, you know, and I know, that if I give you 24 hours, you ain't gonna do nothing but drink the entire goddamn time. You ain't gonna be in any better condition tomorrow than you are right now.
Dempster ran his hand across his face, then looked over at Matt.
He's right. A 24-hour delay isn't gonna do me an ounce of good. So what do you say?
Mr. Dempster, it doesn't look to me like I have much say in this at all.
You don't. And I'm glad you can keep your sense of humor.
Bailiff, call the court.
Oh, yes, oh, yes, oh, yes. Everybody stand up. This here court is now in session.
Cummins sat, then banged the handle of his pistol on the table.
Be seated, Mr. Prosecutor. Make your case.
Nobody responded.
Hayes, that's you.
Oh, yeah.
Hayes stood up and looked toward the jury.
Well, here's what happened. We was all in here when Deputy Gillis went out front. Next thing you know, we heard a shot. Then Gillis, he come walking back into the room just like nothing had happened at all. Then, all of a sudden, he fell on the floor dead. But before even anyone could say, how do you do, this here fella come in behind him. He had a gun in his hand, and the gun, well, it was still smoking. And get this, Moe's pistol still in his holster. Now, there ain't one man in here who didn't hear the gunshot, and there ain't one man in here who didn't see what I just told you. So there ain't no doubt at all but that defendant is guilty.
He sat down. Then, in a bit of showmanship, he stood up and bowed to the others in the saloon.
That'll be enough, Hayes.
Sorry, Marshal.
You will address me as Your Honor.
Your Honor.
Defense?
Your Honor, I call Matt Jensen to testify in his own behalf.
Matt was sworn in, then took a chair. Matt testified for himself, explaining how Gillis had confronted him with a demand for $5 for a visitor's tax.
I didn't know anything about the tax. I'd never heard of a visitor's tax, not in this town or any town I've ever visited. So it was my intention to just ride on out of town. But the deputy wouldn't let me. He said that just by being here, I was already a visitor.
Well, what he said was correct, and as the deputy, he had every right to collect $5 from you. $5 is to pay for law enforcement.
There's nothing right about that.
Uh-huh. And so, since you didn't agree with him, you shot him. Is that it? You shot him down in cold blood.
Your Honor, I object. It is not yet redirect.
Well, I'm gonna allow the question.
It wasn't even a question. It was an interruption. I haven't turned the witness over to him yet.
We're after the truth here, Counselor. No matter what technique we use to get it, I'm gonna allow the question. Answer it, Jensen.
No, sir. I did not shoot him down in cold blood. He drew on me first. I was faster, and when I shot him, his gun somehow just slipped back into his holster. It's the truth, I swear it.
Mister, there ain't one person in all Arizona who was faster than Mo Gillis was.
I am.
I have no more questions, Your Honor.
All right. Give your closing arguments.
Dempster held up his finger, then walked back to the table where he had left the coffee. He poured himself another cup, then drank it before he returned to address the jury.
You have heard the defendant say that Gillis drew on him first. And since Mr. Jensen is the only eyewitness to the actual confrontation, his testimony should have some weight. We all knew Gillis. We all knew what a hothead he was. And we all know that it would not be out of character for him to draw first, especially if he thought he was right to defend some law, such as collecting a $5 visitor's tax fee. But you have the perception that Mr. Jensen drew first because the pistol was still in Gillis's holster. Perception. I'd like to remind you that according to the law, you can only find my client guilty if you are convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that he is guilty. You cannot find him guilty based upon a perception of guilt. In addition to this, I'd like to point this out to you. If you find him guilty as charged, there is an excellent chance that the sentence will be overturned on appeal, based upon all the irregularities in this trial. One, there could be a real question as to Andrew Cummins' authority to try this case, seeing as he acted as the arresting officer. There is no precedence for the arresting officer to also act as judge. Two, the Constitution of the United States guarantees every man a competent lawyer to act as his defense. All of you know me. I am a trained lawyer, this is true. But I am also a drunk, and I was only given 15 minutes to prepare for this case. And finally, I was given no opportunity for voir dire. I believe this jury to be incapable of rendering a fair decision based upon the fact that you were all present at the time of the incident. I ask you to find Mr. Jensen not guilty.
Ha! There ain't a chance in hell we're gonna do that.
Cummins banged his revolver on the table.
That's an order! Order!
He looked over at Hayes.
Mr. Hayes, your summation.
What?
It's your turn to talk to the jury to wrap up your case.
Oh, yeah. Right.
For a long moment, he said nothing. Then he pointed to Matt.
Yeah, this son of a bitch is guilty. You know it, and I know it, and I say, let's hang the bastard.
All right, it's now time to poll the jury. Jury, how do you find the defendant?
Guilty! Guilty!
Well, yeah, so say you won, so say you all.
Yeah, that's what we all say.
Mr. Matt Jensen, you have been found guilty of murder and are sentenced to hang.
I'll get a rope.
String the son of a bitch out right here in front of the saloon for the whole town to see.
No, I told you, we just gonna do this all legalized. You'll be put on tonight's train and taken to the territorial prison in Yuma, where the execution will be carried out.
Who are you gonna send with them?
Why, you volunteering?
Yeah, I'll see to it that that son of a bitch gets to Yuma.
Now, Hayes, you was the one wanting to string him up now. I don't know if I can trust you to get him there safe.
I'll get him there. You got my word.
I'm not going to let you put a convicted murderer in the same car as paying passengers.
Y'all, come on, Randall. He's been tried, all legal, and we gotta get him to Yuma to hang. I ain't gonna trust him on a horse, and we can't walk all the way.
I suppose you two can ride an express car.
The express car? Yeah, all right, that'll be fine. We'll ride in the express car.
Hayes looked over at Matt, who had said nothing from the moment the marshal had put him in the shackles.
All right, killer man. Take a seat out there in the waiting room, and don't give me no trouble if you know what's good for you.
Even before the train arrived, Emma Dawkins and her son Timmy were just down the street from the depot, standing in front of a small brick building looking at a sign.
Robert Dempster, attorney at law.
They had been across the street in a dress shop when Matt Jensen came into town, and though Emma hadn't seen anything, her son Timmy said that he had witnessed the entire showdown.
What are we doing here, Mama?
This man is a lawyer. I want you to tell him what you saw. Hello? Anybody here?
Dempster came in from the back room.
I'm here. You are Mrs. Dawkins, aren't you? The dentist's wife?
Yes.
What can I do for you, Mrs. Dawkins?
My son and I were in Millie's dress shop. A few minutes ago, we saw Deputy Hayes come out of the saloon with a man in shackles.
Yes, the man in shackles would be Matt Jensen.
Why is he in shackles?
Why? Because he's just been found guilty of murder. He's being sent by train to Yuma Prison to be hanged.
For shooting Deputy Gillis?
Yes. Excuse me, Mrs. Dawkins, but how do you know this? This just happened.
Well, I seen the whole thing.
Saw?
I saw it.
What did you see?
I seen... I saw Deputy Gillis draw his gun first. Then the other man drew his gun faster, and he shot the deputy. Well, I didn't know we killed the deputy, because all I saw was Deputy Gillis turn around and walk back into the saloon.
You say you saw the deputy draw his gun first?
Well, yes, sir, I did.
Well, that's not possible. When Gillis came back into the saloon, his pistol was still in his holster.
He pulled his gun about halfway out. Then when he got shot, it fell back in the holster. But he drew first.
Timmy, have you seen very many gunfights?
No, sir. I haven't never seen any except this one.
Mm-hmm. Neither have I, actually. But I've tried cases that had to do with gunfights, and the one thing all of them have in common is confusion. Two people can see the same thing but tell completely different stories without either one of them lying.
Well, how can they tell something different without one of them lying?
Because it isn't a lie if you believe what you are saying is the truth. Take your story, for example. I don't believe you're lying. I think you really believe that you saw Deputy Gillis draw first. But a gunfight can be over in the wink of an eye. It could be that when Gillis saw this fella Jensen starting to draw, that he went for his own gun. But it was too late. The other fella had the drop on him. You might have seen Gillis starting his draw, but didn't notice that the other fella had already drawn his own gun.
Timmy didn't answer.
Don't you think it might have been that way?
No, sir. It wasn't that way. I know what I saw. I saw the stranger, Mr. Jensen, come riding into town on a sorrel. He was a tall man, with broad shoulders and a wet hat.
A wet hat?
Yes, sir. He must have given his horse some water from a hat, because the hat was wet, and he took it off and he hung it on his saddle. Then Deputy Gillis came outside, and they talked for a moment, but I don't know what they were talking about. Then Deputy Gillis started to draw his gun, but Mr. Jensen drew his gun, too, and he drew it faster than Deputy Gillis. When he shot Deputy Gillis, the deputy's gun fell back into the holster, and he turned around and went back inside the saloon. And that's what I saw.
Young man, that... That is a very detailed and descriptive observation, and it coincides almost exactly with the way he told it.
With the way who told it?
Matt Jensen. I defended him in the trial.
You mean they've already had the trial?
Yes, ma'am, I'm afraid so. I sure wish you'd come forward earlier. I could have used Timmy's testimony then.
Well, maybe it isn't too late. Maybe you can go see Marshal Cummins and he'll change his mind.
No, Cummins will not change his mind.
Come on, Timmy. Mr. Dempster, I'm sorry we bothered you.
It's not a bother, Mrs. Dawkins. The boy was just doing what he thought was right, that's all. And nobody can fault him for that.
Dempster waited until Emma and Timmy left. Then he closed his office and hurried back down to the saloon. Since the trial, the saloon had returned to normal, and there were scores of people there, drinking and reliving the great drama of the trial so recently played out before them. Cummins was sitting at his usual table in the back of the room, and Dempster went straight to him.
Well, the counselor's back.
Cummins had a bottle of whiskey on the table, and he poured some into a glass.
Now go ahead and drink up. It's your pay for defending an indigent client.
No thanks.
What? Oh, shit, Bob Dempster refusing a drink? Oh, quick, someone get hold of the publisher of The Purge. This should be front page headlines. Robert Dempster, run down, has been lawyer, refuses the offer of a drink.
Oh, Marshal, I think you ought not to be so quick about sending Jensen to Yuma.
Oh, and why is this?
Something's come up. New evidence. Evidence I did not have when I made the case for my client.
And just what is the evidence?
You know Emma Dawkins, don't you? The dentist's wife?
Yeah, I know her. Quite a handsome woman, as I recall.
Well, she and her son just paid me a visit. Her son, Timmy is his name, was an actual witness to the shooting. He is a remarkably astute young man, and he tells the same story that Jensen did. He says that Gillis started his draw, but Jensen was faster, shot him, and Gillis's pistol slipped back into the holster. I think you should send someone down to the depot before the train arrives and bring Jensen back.
Oh, that's what you think, is it?
Yes, sir, it is.
How the hell old is that boy?
I don't know, 10, 11, 12 maybe.
You think his word carries some weight?
Sure, why not? He has no vested interest in this case. And as I said, he's quite articulate. I see no reason why his word would be challenged.
Challenged, that's a good word for it. Because I have an eyewitness that would challenge him.
Marshal, when you say eyewitness, you can't use the people who were here in the saloon as eyewitnesses because none of them actually saw the event. All they saw was the result of the event.
One of them actually saw the event, and he will challenge the boy.
You have a real eyewitness?
Yeah.
I don't understand. If you have a real eyewitness, why wasn't his testimony used in the trial?
Well, we didn't need his testimony during the trial. We found Jensen guilty without his testimony.
Who was the eyewitness?
Jackson!
Yes, Marshal.
You were standing at the window watching when Jensen drew on Mo. Wasn't you?
Well, no, sir. Marshal, don't you remember? I was over at the table with the rest of you.
No, you wasn't. You were standing by the window just looking outside.
No, sir.
Listen to me. You were standing by the window. You saw it all. You saw Mo talking to Jensen, and you saw Jensen suddenly draw his pistol and shoot Deputy Gillis. Do you remember now?
Yes, sir. I remember. And that's just how I seen it happen, too. Mo asked the stranger.
Not stranger, Jensen. You have to be very specific about that. It was Matt Jensen.
Yes, sir. Mo asked Matt Jensen to pay the visitor's tax. And Jensen got so mad that he pulled iron and killed Deputy Gillis in cold blood.
Now I want you to write that out and sign it.
Before. We done had a trial.
God damn it, Jackson. Will you just do the hell what I tell you to do without giving me any goddamn argument?
Yes, sir. I'll be glad to write it out on a piece of paper for you.
And sign it?
Yes, sir, and sign it.
Cummins watched as Jackson wrote out his statement, then signed it.
Now, Mr. Lawyer, you put the word of a young boy against the sworn word of Deputy Jackson. Now we'll see which one of us gets the furthest.
Dempster reached down to grab the glass of whiskey. He tossed it down in one swallow without so much as a grimace, then pointed a finger at Cummins.
You railroaded that man, Marshal. That man's going to be hung for something he didn't do, and you are responsible for it.
Well, if I am, I reckon I'm just gonna have to live with it, aren't I?